said.
Don't believe what I just saw.
I'm a man. I'm 40.
This is John Sheezer. I'm here.
Eric Marino.
Eric.
No, I gotta tell you about the Clippers. I'm an
addict. Sportsaholics, I gotta.
Let's just hope this shit doesn't go viral.
Okay.
All right, we are back. This is Sportsaholics, episode number 95.
The Chandler Jones Synthetic Marijuana episode. I'm trying to be the best 95 I can be, Coach.
Wait, is he number 95?
He sure is. He's number 95 for your New England Patriots. Chandler Jones of Syracuse University. I also went to Syracuse University. I try actual marijuana, not synthetic marijuana. But unlike I can't play.
Okay, refresh the listeners. If they didn't catch last week's episode, which
the episode 94 in which one. you talk so much. I'm sorry, why does it just sound like an Atlanta Braves game in here? I don't even know. Or some spring, FSU,
because spring training.
Do you guys have to pay money to FSU or the Atlanta Hawks to
month.
Do that? Are you guys like the Seahawks 12th man?
No, I don't know.
I was nothing but nice. I talked no trash against your Kansas City.
Yes, because you've been to four goddamn straight AFC championships.
No, I'm sorry. You're incorrect. I have been to five consecutive AFC championships games. This is Belichick and Brady's 10th AFC championship game, which, by the way, is three more than a certain guy named Joseph H. Montana. I don't know what is. Joseph Helener Montana. I don't know. But so there's what I'm saying.
Why do you guys get to play in an NFL that has four teams in it every year, and the rest of us have to play in a league that has 32 teams?
First of all, because we know how to run a two-minute drill when we're down by 14, unlike a certain Andy Reid, who, by the way, had done this in a Super Bowl with Donovan McNabb. You guys were down by 14. You were driving, and suddenly the clock was running. You know, your receivers, by the way, meant valiant efforts to get extra yardage, but stupid time decisions to stay in bounds and go for four more yards when you could have saved yourself timeouts and saved clock. You guys didn't score till into the 2 minute, after the 2 minute warning. What was happening was criminal. And the fact that I was so happy to say, after the way you talk smack, and I was nothing but complimentary. Because honestly, and I still say this because we have a lot of fans, lots of sportsaholics out there in Kansas City. You guys are a great fan base. And I honestly, if it wasn't us, I definitely would be rooting for you against that undying zombie known as Peyton Manning. We need to stop the Walking Dead right here in Denver. We need to finally put that pickaxe through his brain and stop him forever. I'm trying to just be the, I want this to be the last game that Peyton Manning plays. I want to end his career in a very nice ride off into the sunset, but the Patriots go to the Super Bowl kind of way.
Have Tom Brady walk out there, pull the sword out of the frozen mile-high tundra.
Yes.
And then
ride their Bronco all the way. Yes.
His Bronco and
take
off.
Yeah, he just climbs on that gigantic Bronco statue and actually comes to life, and now it's Tom's winged Pegasus, and he takes it to his fifth Super Bowl ring.
Can we have it right as he exits the stadium, John Elway comes out and he just runs him over?
Now, also, guys, you should know that Chandler Jones, who's a great defensive end for my New England Patriots, and he wears number 95, and he went to Syracuse University. He recently walked into he lives down the street from a police station. And early one
right
Saturday
in.
Or Sunday morning, he strolled right in without any shoes on, without a shirt on, and he was, as the police report says, disoriented. He had to go to the hospital. The cops evidently went with him to lock up his house. They got his keys off his counter. They happened to observe what's known as a Class D substance, which is either a synthetic marijuana or like a phenobarbital, or a fen kind of like dietary substance, thing like that, which is, it may be unwise, but it's not illegal, and it's not against evidently NFL rules. So apparently Chandler Jones doesn't get disciplined at all because we need him very badly to put pressure on the Denver Broncos offense this AFC championship.
And apparently, he needed to get high enough to relieve the pressure of Bill Belichick.
Well, I mean, he had a lot. Maybe he had a little bit of angst as he took your Chiefs very, very seriously. And we talked no smack. You had an 11-game winning streak. I think you guys have really turned the corner. Every New England fan is dying for the AFC West champion to change. We're all waiting for Bronco and King Peyton to get toppled. We all want – you have to understand that every New England Patriot fan is rooting twice a year for the Raiders, twice a year for the Chargers, and twice a year for your Chiefs so you could fucking beat Peyton Manning. But you never fucking help us. No one ever helps us, and we always have to go and do it ourselves. So we're going to Denver. We don't have home field advantage, which is my father's fault, but – we're going to win. We're going to kill him. We lost in Denver, which now I'm thinking is very motivational because we've played there already. It's very hard to beat any team twice in a season. I really want to beat them. I really, really want it. I really, really want it. I really, 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 really want it. And now we might need to take a break just so I can regain my fucking consciousness.
Yeah, just breathe. Take it easy. I'll talk about today's episode.
Let's do that.
Fantastic. We've got Molly Secour on, who she just... She's just about finished with an incredible documentary. It's called Scouting for Diamonds. It goes behind the scenes with, you know, your 200,000, you know, miles on the odometer scout that drives around, the higher up one that flies around.
And she's a great person who never talks trash when her team is facing another team, unlike certain co-hosts.
Yeah, well, you know what? Our teams don't really face each other that often. I can't remember the last time, and I think that was the first time ever in the playoffs. And yeah, I put $20 down on the game.
I was hardly mean. I was confident. I wish you good things.
I was not mean, and there is definitely a difference. I had no way insulted your team.
I think you were overconfident, maybe cocky.
Maybe a little bit cocky, but I would just say mean. I was not. I was happy with all the behind the scenes stuff going on with the fake marijuana smoking. There seemed to be a little turmoil in the locker room.
We didn't know what was going on. Belichick had a black eye in a press conference on a Tuesday before the game. Gronkowski had evidently shown up on a Thursday in the hospital to get treatment, which when asked, he said was maintenance. Like, he's a robot. It was like his cyborg. He had to go get a lube job on his bionic calf muscles. And then you didn't know what you were going to get with Edelman and Amendola. And even Brady himself had a mysterious high ankle sprain by Ndamukong Suh and the Miami Dolphins, which is exactly what I didn't want to happen. Even when the Dolphins are out of it, they're still just – Ndamukong Suh was totally meaningless for an entire season. He takes till week 17 to hurt Tom Brady going into the playoffs. Like, I didn't need any of that, people. But here we are, AFC Championship, and you knew it was going to happen. Let's talk about that Pittsburgh thing, too, and that fumble. They live by the fumble. They died by the fumble. I was more than happy to play the Steelers at home, but evidently fate and NFL marketing just won't let me not play Peyton Manning one last time. The 17th time, once again, for all the marbles.
How perfect is that, a whole season's worth of Broncos-Patriots over the past – I guess, what has that been?
Oh, wow. I hear what you're saying.
You know, since
you're saying the two of them have literally played more than a season's worth of football against each other.
Head to head. And when are we going to ever see that again? I mean, I guess if you would, maybe Carson Palmer, but who's he gone up against?
No, but and also Carson hadn't. He just won like his first playoff game. He hadn't been to one in six years.
I was so happy to see that.
He had those dark Raider years.
Oh, man.
He was also
unforgotten. I'd completely forgot.
I mean, it was like he also had his knee blown out in the very first play of his first playoff game. I mean, he was a young
rising star. Against the Steelers 10 years. That was that. I was watching that game. The Steelers took out knees. It looked dirty. It definitely looked dirty. It
didn't look like healthy.
And it was one of those things. And I watched the Napoleon McCallum knee injury in 94 with the Raiders Monday Night Football where cleat plants into the turf, gets hit from both sides, does a 360, but his leg never moves. Yeah, it was disgusting. But this one was equally, like, he gets hit on the right side of his right leg, and his knee just bends inside. You're like, oh, the knees don't bend like that. And it was an injury that was bad enough. Not quite Frank Gifford, you know, bad. Yeah. But it was one of those where you're like, wow, he might not be back, which is a shame because he had the Bengals – which at the time, this pre-AJ Green, the Bengals didn't really have anything going back then. They had Travis Henry, who I think was still alive before he got thrown out of the back of a truck and killed by his baby's mama. That was the Bengals all-pro wide receiver right around that time. But to see him now 10 years later, and then for me too, Carson Palmer was just like, you could still feel his presence in Los Angeles because he had just gotten the Heisman thing. He put USC back on the map. They were then
right.
They took the baton with Leinart and Bush, you know, in 94, 95, 96, you know. And
there's a weird point where Carson Palmer was completely eclipsed and washed up, and now has had this resurgence. It's amazing. I'm very interested. Let's talk. What do you think is going to happen? The NFC has always been all season. They had the undefeated Panthers, but perhaps Arizona, I thought, was a better team. And now we're going to see it on the field. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's going to be, I think, a Larry Fitzgerald, Cam Newton battle. Oddly enough, even though he's a wide receiver, this is the most important game of his career.
What he did in overtime to end that game after Aaron Rodgers had thrown two Hail Marys was really incredible.
I really think they're going to have to game plan like, we're going to get him the ball 20 times. He's going to get us three touchdowns somehow.
Well, I liked how they got that touchdown in overtime by having a direct pitch to him, a forward. I think technically a forward pass or a shovel pass.
I like that too. And it was the, give the ball to our captain, let him score. It says a lot.
Best athlete decided the game. You have to say that the Packers were, hey, you bested our Spaniard. You beat our best guy. Like, Aaron Rodgers had just done a miracle thing, and then you just came and kind of swiped us right out.
And I was just happy that they showed up. I was just, tired of seeing like horrible, playoff games that were over. After like the Seattle game, that game was horrible to watch, but man, what a great result. I mean, what an amazing outcome to just see. Seattle. Yeah, you came back. And I guess if you're a fan, you're kind of thinking, man, we got a shot even with 8 minutes left. I think they got it back to within 10 or something. But this was a classic case of Carolina being up 31 points and saying, we do have this actually in this game is over. So we don't have to go 100%. And I think that's the only reason that game got as close as it did. But I really feel like the Seattle thing is trending downward. Marshawn Lynch, you got to understand, that guy carried not only like a large percentage of the actual carries for the team, but did so much physically, blocking, catching little screen passes. Taking a lot of pressure off of Russell Williams.
It's to the point where it's like, I think you're seeing a guy who never played the media game. He wasn't necessarily beloved in that special athlete way because he didn't make himself endearing to people. And in some ways, it was like, I think he was that unlikable guy that was the best player on his team and really much more of the foundation than anybody realizes. Because when you take him away, we don't really know what's – it's like – look, Seattle as a franchise once went to it. They went to a playoff game like at 7-9, right? And they won
3 years. Yeah, yeah.
Right, and then in some ways, I even say it's like people forget that like Arizona was a dominant team last year and probably should have been they should have probably been the best team in the NFC last year, but they lost Carson Palmer and then they lost the backup to that, and they were basically down to their third, fourth, and then fifth backup quarterbacks, and they couldn't win in the playoffs. And so maybe Seattle's second Super Bowl was really – this should have been Arizona's from last year, if you know what I'm saying. But by the twist of fate, this guy gets out, so they can't.
And maybe that twist of fate is, having – I actually like Pete Carroll as a coach.
Right, but the Seahawks now have paid a lot of money to Russell Wilson, and they're not, and Marshawn Lynch is going to be gone, and we're going to – in some ways, you're going to like, well, how good is Russell Wilson without maybe the best running back – in the NFL.
And you can't argue, yeah, they have a great defense, but every year that defense adds 17 games, and if the playoff, 18 games under that player's career, it's like they're going to slow down.
And I think it's they might not be as good. In other words, they were better when you didn't know that they were called the Legion. Before they were the Legion of Boom, they might have actually been better because they were deeper. And now it's like, you know the name, like, hey, the four guys that are the starters are now also may have NFL name recognition across the country. But maybe because they haven't had Bronner in 2 years, it's like they're not actually as good as before everyone knew their name.
No, I would agree with that, because, I mean, when you get into the playoffs with a sub-500 record,
right,
people are going to sleep on you, you know, and then before it's too late, you got momentum going and fucking Super Bowl champion.
And in some ways, it's like you want to be the cornerback. You want to be the cornerback in secondary that's on the rise and making a name, instead of having a name and having a name and then getting burned. Like, you know, it's like being a good closer in baseball. It's like secondaries, you know, it's a combination of athletics and balls. And sometimes you have to, some seasons, you know, who do I had? I had, what's his name? Papelbon. And sometimes Papelbon was great. And sometimes, you know, it's like, and these things can come and go in a heartbeat. And secondaries, cornerbacks, relief pitchers, they can have great seasons and it could vanish next year. And like, and you won't, it's like, hey, it's still Cam Chancellor and Richard Sherman. Why aren't they the Legion of Boom anymore? And that's what you're saying. 17
right,
games.
Yeah, it's like Revis Island is slowly going to turn into Revis Continent because they're going to have to start playing more zone.
Right. Like
he's
everybody,
slow down.
Like everybody in Boston likes to share articles that are saying that basically for the money, Malcolm Butler, what they got out of Malcolm Butler versus Darryl Revis for the money was completely worth it. No one is trying to say that Malcolm Butler is better than Revis. No one is saying that. No one in New England thinks that to be true. But as Revis as an asset starts to decline, he's not as much. He's not worth that top dollar.
Yeah, that year three at $12 million,
right, we could,
isn't going to stack up.
There was a point where Tom Brady gets the most money on offense. And he keeps renegotiating basically his contract down because he's about winning and he's married to Giselle and money isn't an issue and he can make endorsements wherever he wants. Now, 2 years ago, Vince Wilfork was definitely, he was a tentpole of our defense by being that unbelievable frontline stuffer. And he was making like, I don't know, $10 million. And that was like the tent pole for defense. And everyone else had to make less than that. And they were going to make money work around that. Now, why did they get rid of Vince Wilfork? Why is he suddenly on Hard Knocks in Houston and on the Texans? Because the Patriots thought, and as it turned out, fortunately, rightly, that they could get Malcolm Brown in their first round from Texas and get, you know, Vince Wilfork,
comparable,
right? Like, but
maybe a
right.
little faster step, but not
yes.
as much knowledge and experience. Right. But you know, something they can mold and be like,
I'm not. Hey, my car doesn't go as fast, but guess what? I save $100 on a lease every month. I'm saving money, and then I can, and then that allows me. It's like, you know, remember the Patriots aren't just contending this year. They don't have a draft pick, which they don't have a first round draft pick, which you know they're going to actually make an advantage by. They don't have to pay a first round draft pick salary. So now they get to move money around and give some guys some bonuses or find this other guy or throw that. It's like 2 years ago, they were willing to throw money at Revis and Bronner and make a run for it. Now they've made a run for it. And now it's like, hey, what if they go get a comparable Randy Moss type receiver that is frustrated and wants to get a ring finally? Like, if we really have a deep threat or, a breakaway threat, somebody, a receiving compliment to what Amendola and Edelman and Gronkowski do, who knows what could happen? And Dion, you know, it's like, we're coming back. By the way, we want this Super Bowl. We want to win this game. We want to win a Super Bowl. And then, you know, we want to contend again. We have a great, It's the good times.
Well, okay.
Five.
Five
AFCs.
Four.
One Belichick. And Tom Brady in Giselle's tree.
Smoking synthetic weed.
Yeah, that's on the 11th day.
That was the, all right. Well, look, we're going to go from.
We have to scrape Marino off the ceiling. And when we do, we'll be back.
I'm saying, like, for as much as I gave you last week, like, that's,
I took it. I took it like a gentleman. I was rooting for you. I would be rooting for you guys this week because someone had to stop. I don't want to lose to the Steelers, and I don't want to lose to the fucking Broncos. I want to win.
Yeah. Please beat the Broncos. I just want – if Denver,
right.
You got nothing
going.
Because
then if he wins, he's going to be like, oh, well, maybe he is the greatest of all time. No, he's not. No, he's not. Brady's gone to 6 Super Bowls. He's trying to get to number 7. 10 AFCs.
Dude, just on Peyton Manning's posture alone, he can't be the greatest quarterback of all time. He's too stiff. He's just awkward looking. Penalized definitely for the Papa John's commercials. I don't care if Joe Montana, what the hell are you doing in those things, by the way?
Making money. Have you seen that? By the way, Kansas City, have you seen the strongest running back? Have you seen the Bo Jackson commercial?
Is this the one where he invites him over, or he's like,
no, it's the one where they're talking about the strongest. You know, it's like it's strongest quarterback, and he's sitting there because we have two of the best strongest receivers, Jerry Rice and Montana's sitting next to Emmitt Smith or whatever. And he's like, well, you know, we have the strongest running back of all time here. And Bo Jackson is standing by the fire. And he picks up baseball bat. Oh, really? he's the strongest running back ever? And he breaks a bat over his knee.
Yeah, strongest all time, huh? Crack.
And he throws it right in the fire. Yeah, and that's, another one.
Dude, that's a great. Well, all right. We're going to go into – I talked with Molly Secor, who's the producer and director, along with co-producer Wade Box, on a great movie called Scouting for Diamonds, which I mentioned, talked about briefly.
Number 26,
briefly earlier.
Retiring Wade Boggs' number.
But she got some great interviews and great insight, you know, from legendary people.
Wow,
Hall
Wade
of Boggs famers.
Is co-producing?
Art Stewart's in there, George Brett.
This documentary is going to hit for a high
great.
Average.
In fact, listeners, go to scoutingfordiamonds.com. There's the trailers on there.
Scouting for diamonds. Well, find one
great.
In the rough.
She's based out of Nashville. We get into like possible baseball expansion there and just kind of how she got started in the movie and, you know, what it was like interviewing Willie Mays and guys like George Brett and, you know, historical baseball figure. So when we come back, guys, we'll be talking with Molly Secor of Scouting for Diamonds. And that's right, go to scoutingfordiamonds.com. And it's not just baseball fans, sports fans, just people that love good movies. Definitely worth checking out.
20 years in the minor leagues, ain't no place I didn't go. Well, I got a few hits, but I never made the show. I could hang on for a few years, doing what I'd done before. Won't let that laughing river flow right outside my door.
All right, we are back with the director-producer, Molly Secor of Scouting for Diamonds. A great project, a great documentary. If you go to scoutingfordiamonds.com, you can check out the trailer. It's fantastic. Molly, how are you doing? You're calling all the way from what I understand, very cold and snowy Nashville, Tennessee. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. And, you know, it's only snowy and cold in our little imagination. It would be a heat wave in Iowa. So, but we have snow today and everybody's having a great time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as long as you can get out, especially if you're a kid and you haven't seen snow in your life. I mean, that's like a freak thing.
Oh, yeah. No, and they're down in the golf course. I just walked 2 blocks down and they got their little, you know, sleds and saucers. And, you know, there's not even an inch of snow, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, and that's good advice, too. If you're listening, kids, which you probably shouldn't be, parents, if you're listening, you know that. Anytime there's snow, head directly to a golf course, and you're in for a great time.
That's really true.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sure the golf course
left. I grew up on the golf course, the 18th hole out of Tomahawk off of Midland Drive in Shawnee, Kansas. That's, you know, that's where I went every time it snowed.
Well, it's the best sledding in town over here, that's for sure.
Sledding aside, I love this movie, Molly, and I'm a sucker for baseball, and I'm really fascinated with this entire documentary. It's co-produced by Wade Boggs, listeners. Now that's huge right there. Do you know Wade Boggs, or how did you meet him?
Well,
or lifelong friends? Like,
I'll He's a great guy, and I met him a year and a half ago.
Perfect.
After the scout that found him and signed him to the Red Sox, George Digby, passed away. And a couple of guys had come to me a week before and said, hey, there's this scout in Gallatin, Tennessee. He found Wade Boggs and a lot of other guys, was with the Red Sox. We'd like you to interview him. You know, maybe you want to do like a little video about him. So they started telling me about him, and I was going to go meet him on the Monday. He died on the Saturday, and he was 96 years old. So I never got to meet George Digby.
Oh, wow.
And about a month and a half later, I was introduced to him through one of his friends over email and told him about the film and that we'd like to talk to him about George Digby and would he. And we had a couple exchanges, and it didn't take long for Wade to say yes. He was very, very, you know, enthused about it and said yes. So we, you know, we got it together, booked some tickets, and went down and interviewed Wade and Jody Reed and Mike Greenwell, and then went to see Boo Ferris in Mississippi. And Wade was just wonderful. I mean, I thought we were going to get 15 minutes with him. We spent 90 minutes with him, and it was really probably one of the most beautiful interviews I've ever done in all of my time as a filmmaker and a writer. He was very, very forthcoming and vulnerable, and was very, you know, he just really paid homage to George Digby and credited him with his success.
That's incredible. Molly, I'm going to have to stop. Apparently, they're cutting a tree down right outside where we're recording
now.
I'm looking outside, and a tree is just shaking. Pardon me. I'm going to pause this for a second. Pardon me for 1 second. All right. Sorry about that little delay there. The city of San Diego decided to start chopping down trees and put the mulcher right outside the studio here. So that was that. Now that they're gone, we were interrupted. You were discussing Wade Boggs and just his, you know, personal vested interest with scouting, which, you know, most players would have one guy, but it seemed like this was like the guy for Mr. Boggs. You know, there was just, was there like a personal connection, you know, like father like type thing, or was it just, was he that much of a miss that everyone, you know, didn't want anything to do with him, and that Wade Boggs like kind of felt like he really was the only guy that gave him a chance?
Well, I think there were probably other people looking at him, and you hear, you know, this is the interesting thing about doing a film. You hear different versions from different scouts or guys that have looked at scouting reports from that time. Certainly Wade Boggs was a viable candidate from everything I've read, but it was George Digby that, you know, put the faith in him and really chose him at a time where he wasn't quite sure what was going to happen. So, you know, and what happened in his 5 years of being in the minors, you know, George Digby, not only did he sign him, but he followed up with him for those 5 years. He wrote him letters. He sent him prayers. You know, I mean, George Digby, you know, was once he was in your corner, that was it.
Yeah, you know what? And I've just heard stories and read stories about those minor league experiences. And you're in all those towns that you just drive through on the interstates. If you're even lucky enough to be in a town that has an interstate that goes through it, then, you know, that's got to be tough. And so to have someone follow up like that, be like, okay, this guy actually cares, and he's actually doing exactly what he said. He didn't lie to me, and so that means that everything else he said is probably going to happen. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, 25 years or 30 years later, you know, is in Cooperstown.
Exactly. And, you know, and whether you ended up being a Hall of Famer or not, he stuck with his guys. In fact, after we hung up the phone a little while ago, I got a call from a guy who was drafted by George Digby back in the 80s, John Mitchell, who ended up playing for the Red Sox for a while. And he wanted to share his story about Digby. He heard about the film from somebody earlier in the week. You know who it was from? It was a person who's become a big supporter of the film, Clint Hurdle, who's with the Pirates.
Yeah,
and he's very much a supporter of the film, has been, you know, sort of letting people know, sending them the trailer and getting them to, you know, support the film. But he heard about it from one of Clint's daily emails that he sends out. He does inspirational emails, and he got that email and called me and said, you know, George Digby signed me, and he actually, you know, was looking at my brother for a time, and he signed Tommy Bolton, who also lives here in Nashville. And, you know, he called to talk about Mr. Digby. He went to his funeral two years ago when he died. But he said, I just needed to tell somebody what an amazing man he was.
You know, and that's good, too, because, you know, that's the theme of scouting. It's unheralded. It's there's no mention of these guys. No one, you know, no fan at a game would ever stop any scout and be excited to talk to them. Well, in my case, Art Stewart, which, you know, he's legendary. So he kind of, you know, doesn't really fit in the mold of a modern day scout. But yeah, there's little to no recognition outside of, you know, the general manager's office.
Well, that's true. When we started, we were at spring training last year, and we went around and interviewed people in the crowd, and a lot of these are diehard baseball fans that go to spring training games. And so we'd say, who's your favorite player? And they'd say, Willie Mays or George Brett or whoever, really quickly. And who's your favorite team? Oh, it's the Mets, it's the Yankees, it's the, you know, the Diamondbacks, of course, were there. So, and then you say, who's your favorite scout? And then there'd be this big, long pause. complete silence. And a lot of times people would just bowl over laughing, saying, I don't think I could name a scout. And, you know, that's how they, and this was like all day long interviewing people. There was not one person. And then finally there was a guy who was an usher, and he thought of, you know, 20 minutes later, he came and ran after us and said, I just remembered one. He's my favorite. Well, it's the only one he could remember.
That's
so.
Yeah, it's a special. What is the makeup of a scout? Is it primarily just retired baseball players or coaches, or are there some people that just get into scouting that didn't play baseball? Is that even a thing? Could you even do that?
It's all over the map. I mean, the stories we hear from people. I mean, you know, there are high school teachers, of course, maybe part-time coaches. Gary Hughes, who's a scout for the Red Sox, you know, his story is he was teaching high school and he was a coach. And, you know, his car broke down on his way home one day. And, you know, he had, I think he had four flat tires, and he realized he needed new tires and he couldn't afford it on a teacher's income. And he said he went to the school and said, I got to quit. I can't even get here anymore. And they said, what do you mean? What are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to become a baseball scout. And they said, no, we'll buy you some new tires. I mean, it's just this crazy thing. And he went from being a teacher to a scout. And this was, I believe it was 40-some years ago. And, you know, there are guys who are former players, of course, guys that never made it. You know, they played in high school. They tried out. Maybe they made it in the minors for 1 year. And what we're finding is that people will do anything, no matter what it is, somehow they want to be connected with baseball. And being a scout is one of those ways that you can do the thing you love. You know, most of them talk about, I've never worked a day in my life because I go to baseball fields every day and look for players.
Yeah, then that's you know, I ran into that even with the independent, you know, with the T-Bones in Kansas City when I was there, you know, working on a project. And that was even independent league, not even major league baseball, but there's a special feeling, and I didn't even work for the T-Bones, but just walking into the stadium, I'm sure you felt that, you know, in the trailer, you know, a couple of your interviews, you know, I believed, you know, were possibly at Kauffman Stadium, did it look like, with Art Stewart and George Brett?
Yes.
Was that the stadium? You know, so it's like when you walk into the stadium with a purpose, you know, you feel, it feels different. You're like, it feels almost magical. You're like, I'm here to do a job and it involves baseball. And that, there's nothing better than that. And yeah, I'm not on the field, but guess what? I'm going to be standing on the field in a couple minutes with a camera or interviewing somebody. So I'm working on the field just like they are. I'm just not wearing a uniform with a number on it, you know?
Right.
And that's, And I wanted to ask you about that too. What was that like? You know, getting sitting down, you know, with George Brett or, you know, Wade Boggs and you know, like Willie Mays and Art Stewart, you know, legends in baseball. Like, does it take a while to even sink in? Like, you're sitting there like, wow, this is happening? Or like, while you're asking questions, you're like, I hope these are good questions, or I would be so nervous doing that.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I don't know. I was certainly a baseball fan when I was a kid, and I was a big Expos fan. I grew up very near Montreal, so it was the Expos and Rusty Staub. Of course, I'm giving my age away now, but that was, you know, I grew up, but I wouldn't say that I was a baseball fanatic. So me doing this film, it's fairly outside of the normal film that I make. Most of my films have been about social and racial justice in some capacity, education, healthcare, criminal justice. So I'm not the person who was following their career every day. I certainly, you know, I knew of Wade Boggs. I watched some games with him. I followed his career. Same with George Brett. I actually was a fairly big George Brett fan.
Thank you.
I'm not the average baseball fanatic going in and talking to their superhero and going to, you know, say, hey, how about that game when you, you know, hit that double in the set? You know, that's not going to be me. So there was a different kind of dynamic going on in the room. And I was there for the scouts. So they're the superstar and they're the Hall of Famer, but I was really there for the scouts. And every one of them got that.
That's
and
great.
I think it's why the interviews are powerful.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, how many times has, you know, someone, the main star, the guy that's always used to being in the spotlight, asked to come in and then not even share it, but just, you know, direct all the attention on the, in this case, being Art Stewart, they were probably relieved almost. You probably got even a more candid side than you normally would if you were just asking them questions about themselves.
Absolutely. And I have to say, you know, there were people that said, I mean, all along the way, this has been a year and a half of people telling me that what I was trying to do was impossible. You're not going to get Wade Boggs. And if you get Wade Boggs, you're going to get him for 10 minutes. And, maybe it'll be worth it, maybe not. Well, he couldn't have been more generous, more open and kind and respectful of George Digby. And I could tell that he loved the opportunity to talk about him and what it meant to him. George Brett loved being there with Art Stewart and talking about scouts. I mean, George Brett has a real fiery passion for scouts and respect for them. You know, he said at one time, he said, I tried it. He said, I went on the road. He said, we went on the road. I made it for 4 or 5 days. I was exhausted. You know, he talks about it in the film when you see the full version. Willie Mays, I have to tell you, I've been around a lot of stars, film stars. I've been around a lot of people who are famous, and I have never felt the way I did. All of my crew and myself never felt like we were in sacred holy ground than when we were with Willie Mays. It was he possesses an assuredness about himself. It's as though Willie Mays was born knowing exactly who Willie Mays was. That's what was so amazing to be around him. There was no question in his mind who he is and what he was here for. And that came across so profoundly and strongly in the interview. And we were there with him for an hour, and he had, you know, left his home and come to the stadium to be with us for an hour and was turning around and going home. And there was a game on. And when he left and we closed the door, my crew and I, all of us started crying. We knew we had just been with somebody very special.
That is incredible. I mean, that's why when you hear people say, oh, I don't know if that's going to work, or, you know, like you example you gave, Wade Boggs is only going to give you 10 minutes. That's why you press on, because what you'll find is the baseball community, fraternity, family, it's so tight-knit. And like you mentioned, like with the email from Clint Hurdle, I believe. Was that correct? But
Yes, Clint Hurdle. Mm-hmm.
Like his email, or you know, in the Independence Project I had worked on. It's amazing. You get one guy, and then all of a sudden, they open up their phone book, and they're like, "Oh, call this guy and this guy and this guy and this guy." And then you speak with those guys, and they all know a couple guys, and it's everyone's willing to share. And you know, especially if you're getting the recommendation kind of in house, you know, from someone they trust and as a friend they've known their entire lives.
And that's where I have to give Wade Robbs credit, because you know, Wade put his faith in me in a way. He came on as, you know, in name as a co-producer, so that might help us, you know, push the project further down the road. And you know, that says a lot. That spoke a lot to me about him, and I really appreciated it, and I will always appreciate his he was the first guy, he was the first one out of the gate. And there was a scout who also helped me early on, and I want to give a shout out to him, Luke Wren with the Diamondbacks. One of the most gracious and thoughtful and kind. He also helped from the very beginning and said, keep trying, and you know, sent his prayers. He's a very spiritual man, and he was very, very gracious is the only word I could use.
And that was, you said Luke Wren?
Luke Wren. W-R-E-N-N with the Diamondbacks. And he was a mentee of George Digby's. He used to be with the Red Sox. And so he felt, you know, in the beginning when the film was more about George Digby in the very first incarnation, Luke was very, very instrumental in getting me interviews with George Zerah and putting me in touch. You know, we interviewed Lou Ferris, who was, you know, a pitcher for the Red Sox in the 40s and is still, you know, still alive and you know, playing, he's not playing baseball, but he's definitely part of the game down there. And so, I mean, a lot of these, and like you said, they just opened up their hearts and their Rolodexes, you know, or their phone books. And it's been a lovely experience for me. And you know, I've told this to other people. Yes, I grew up as a tomboy. I was a big hockey fan. My dad was a hockey player. So, you know, hanging around guys and being around athletes was something that was a lot, you know, a big part of my life. But doing this film and discovering along with, you know, my crew and I, what this whole scouting world is about, this breed of scouts, this sport that we think of as scouting now, I mean, it is its own separate sport. I have fallen completely in love with baseball again, and it's part of the reason I'm convinced that this film isn't just for sports fans. I know people who aren't even big baseball fans are going to fall in love with the film.
You know, anytime you can, you know, open up the window into someone's life and show, and they're dedicated and passionate about something, and at the same time are making a difference in hundreds, if not thousands, of other people's lives. You know, that's a great story, you know, baseball fan or not, you know, there's a lot of compassion and love in underneath baseball. And there is,
and you know, this is the quintessential love story between scouts and baseball. And I haven't run across, and you know, that's the thing is, a lot of guys, whether they're managers or they're presidents of teams or they're assistant to the president or they're assistant to the manager, most of them have done scouting at one time or another, in some form or fashion. You know, they may not have all been bird dogs or area scouts, but they have scouted players at some level. And there is a unique fraternity.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's like boot camp for baseball. Like if you want to actually be respected as you climb the corporate ladder of baseball, then you got to put in, you know, some time as a scout. That way you at least got a little bit of leverage when you're arguing with people.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You want to have been where they've been. And one of the things that, you know, is becoming evident is that it takes a while to learn the game. I mean, and so by the time one of these guys gets to, they've been in the game for 40, 50 years, what they have in their heads is more than any 10-volume encyclopedia could hold. It's amazing the details, the knowledge, the information these men have, not just in their heads, but in their bodies. They can feel when a pitch is coming at them 90 miles an hour or if it's 80 miles an hour. You know, they feel it. And yes, there's sabermetrics and there's all these instruments now and there's all this technology. But you sit down with these guys and you realize that they have something that these tools can't quantify or measure. You know, and I'm and there's a lot of, you know, it seems to me that there's a lot of debate out there, and you know, we're looking at all sides, of course. But I've been blown away by what kind of information they carry inside of them.
It's, you know, I think there's something to the to be said, you know, in as they're sitting there and they're watching and they're, you know, whether they're putting themselves in the game or whatever their method of scouting is, but they've got that pen and they got the paper and they're writing stuff down constantly. And so they're just, it just stuck in their heads, you know, and some of their abilities to recall games from 1976 or 1964, 97, exact innings, pitching situations. It's incredible. And I really, you know, you don't really run across that like in everyday people. It's this weird talent that these guys develop. And I think that's definitely, you know, the ones that are really, really good at that are end up being, you know, the best scouts.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we were interviewing Boo Ferris. I think Dave Ferris was his name, but known as Boo. And I believe he's 96. I'd have to, he's having a birthday sometime around now. So I'm going to guess he's at 96. And he was telling me about games that happened in the late, I think maybe the late 30s, early 40s. And he was recalling, oh, that's when so-and-so hit that double off that left-handed pitcher who just two games before that had blah, blah. I mean, it went on and on. And then he, you know, described what he wore that day and what he had for lunch, you know. I was astounded at the recall. It's almost this super genius type of, I don't even know what to call it. It's, you know, I've joked that it's a form of really highly developed autism, and I mean that in the most positive, complimentary way.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I don't want anybody to think I'm, but it's pretty astounding, and it's not just one or two of them, it's a lot of them.
Yeah, it's, I mean, yeah, we're not talking Dustin Hoffman here in Rain Man, but there it's freakish almost. Well, Molly, hey, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to play the audio from the trailer here for the listeners, and we're going to go to that right now.
I remember the first time they told me I was going to be a scout. And I said, that's wonderful. What do I do? Will you find a ball player? Find a ball player? What does that mean? So they gave me a black book. I opened up the black book. The pages were blank.
A baseball scout is charged with the inconceivable, seeing the future.
It's the guy that looks into a player and sees the intangibles and is able to say, this guy is going to make it to the big leagues.
Somebody had to find the diamond in the rough. Somebody had to find the needle in the haystack.
They went into the bushes, that's what we call it. They went into the bushes to find guys.
They cannot make stars, yet they must decide what players would become legends if the stars aligned.
I had no idea what I was looking at my first event, and I'm just like thinking to myself, can I do this? Like, do I have what it takes to be a scout?
A good scout's not just an evaluator of talent. He has to be a detective in a certain way to find out all he can about the young players.
Because when you go scout a player, the thing you're looking for is not so much throwing, fielding, because you can tell that quickly when you're a scout. What you're trying to find is what he's got inside of him.
I don't think baseball can be completely equated into a math problem.
Maybe how the kid walks onto the on-deck circle, or how he handles himself after a game.
You have to take all these external components into account.
You don't have a radar gun to measure someone's heart.
And that's what your main job is as a scout, is to try and discover what's inside that player. because statistics can't measure that.
Hank Aaron hit cross-handed and didn't hustle. Babe Ruth was thought to be a better pitcher than hitter. Derek Jeter was thought to be a middling prospect to all but a few scouts. And Wade Boggs, who would enter the Baseball Hall of Fame as one of the greatest hitters of all time.
He was a below average runner. He was a below average thrower. He was a below average fielder. He had below average power, but he could hit a little bit.
That was the report until a Boston Red Sox scout named George Digby weighed in.
George had that unique ability to find that diamond in the rough. He could sit there and look at a hitter and say, this kid's got a chance.
To look at a 17, 18-year-old kid and try to project them to where they would be at age 21 or 22 or 25 or 30, I mean, it takes a special eye and a special talent.
He wasn't looking out for me. He was looking at a guy named Alonzo Perry.
First baseman.
I think when he saw me, he switched from Perry to me, and that's when they came by the house and signed me.
When he came over to sign me, he and my dad killed a whole bottle of Spignana.
The most difficult part is being away a lot, especially if you're married and you have children.
I don't know how scouts did it before they had GPS.
Sometimes you get home at 10 at night and you've driven 300 miles that day.
It is like being in the Foreign Legion.
People don't understand scouting. Scouting is probably harder than playing.
I mean, let's be honest, like, we're playing to win a World Series.
How are you going to go to your boss and tell a guy, I just have a feeling? 29 teams may not like a guy, one team may. And that's all it takes is to give that kid a shot.
Every player is like a jigsaw puzzle. And the more pieces you can put into that jigsaw puzzle, the better chance you have of making a correct judgment.
Toughest job in baseball is the area scout.
I know they put in more time, more effort, driven more miles in their car, stayed in crappier hotels, got paid less to, what, enable us the greatest thrill of a lifetime?
You just wonder why God puts people like that on the earth to find people like me.
For more than 100 years, these devoted scouts have remained in the shadows of baseball's greatest legends until now.
All right, so that is the trailer. Guys, go to scoutingfordiamonds.com. You can also find on Twitter at scouting, the number 4, DMNDS. That's at scouting, number 4, DMNDS. Now, Molly, towards the end of that, like, you could kind of hear, you know, Wade Boggs is so passionate about it, you know, it brings him to tears, you know, and so that moment right there just kind of sums up everything that we had just discussed before we got into that trailer, you know, just the passion and love for someone that, you know, not a blood father, not a blood uncle, but someone that he may have even loved more than some of his uncles, you know, meant more to him than, you know, possibly some of his family members.
Well, you know, it did mean a lot. I mean, you know, Wade talks about his dad a lot. His dad was his biggest champion. He had a dad who was definitely hands-on. He made sure that he had all the opportunities to play as much as he needed to play, you know, with the talents that he had and develop them. So Wade had a lot of support at home. Even so, the support that he got from George Digby became a friend of his parents. They, you know, went out on their anniversaries, the birthdays, they celebrated. And that was one thing that was, I mean, George Digby, everyone that I've talked to that was signed by George Digby has a story about how he stayed in touch. The guy that just called me today, John Mitchell, was telling me that until a few years ago, before Mr. Digby died, he was still sending birthday cards and cards to his mother, and, you know, her husband had passed, you know, years before, and he was just one of those people that whoever he was connected to, that was real, and he wasn't just somebody trying to sign up a bunch of baseball players. He knew that it was about relationships. He knew that, you know, that people get better when life is breathed into them, and he gave oxygen. That's what George Digby did, and he did it through relationships and love. And it seems like I talked to Jody Reed and Mike Greenwell, they all said the same thing.
Yeah, that's incredible. You know, and that's you hope there's guys like that now that people will talk about 40 years from now, you know, and say, you know, like Luke Wren, for example, you know, 40 years from now, hopefully, you know, these same stories will be going around about him. You're like, oh, I remember when he was in the Diamondbacks back in 08, this happened.
Right. Yeah.
But I love, you know, and I just love it because, you know, like a big baseball fan, but anytime you can dig underneath, you know, and dig deeper and deeper into the game and just kind of, you know, show what really makes the thing work. You know, I mean, you didn't just get into the engine, like you got into the motor oil, you know, like.
Well, that's what it feels like sometimes. It is pretty deep. And we, like I said, it's why we're doing this campaign. We have a long way to go. We feel pretty comfortable that some bigger investors are going to step in for the heavy lifting, but we decided instead of interrupting our shooting, that, you know, we would put it out there and see if people would support it. And I'll be darned, people want the film made. We've received a lot of support and love. So,
and listeners, you go to scoutingfordiamonds.com. And then from there, there's links where you can donate, you know, and help get this thing to the next step of production so that we can, you know, see it on Netflix or Hulu, rent it, you know, wherever we can find it, you know, would be great because there's tons of baseball knowledge here and stories. I'm a sucker for stories too. You know, anytime you can get an old, you know, player that was around in 1936 or, you know, 1941 and talk about, you know, batting behind Ted Williams, what that was like, you know, it's not an HD, but it's an HD in their mind and they can take you back there through their words. And so the more of that that's captured, I love it. I'm enthralled with the project.
Well, you're who we, and I want to remind people too, is that when they go to the page, we just started up this page in the last less than 48 hours because we did a 2-week campaign and we raised almost 40,000, and they don't let you continue once your time is up. So we had to start a new page. So we just want people to know that, you know, it's been going like hotcakes for the last 2 weeks. We've had to start the marker at zero on this new page. So, I don't want them to think they're not contributing to something that's unpopular. It's very popular.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. You'd figure they would be like, well, okay, you know what, this, you know, this is gonna help, so here, take that. They're like, no, you don't get any. You're like, ah, man, all right, well, we'll do it again. Watch us. And Molly, so you live in Nashville, a very snowy, cold, 32 degree Nashville today. What's the baseball environment there? Because there's been, you know, rumors I saw recently, Nashville, I mean, it was, I believe, number 8 on the top 10 possible cities for baseball expansion or relocation. How would that fit in Nashville? Is the city big enough? I mean, is there enough people that live there to support a team? Is the passion for baseball there, in your opinion?
Well, there's definitely a passion for baseball in Nashville. I mean, that's, you know, undoubtedly true. And I think, you know, I don't know what the numbers need to be for someone to call it, you know, a success. But, you know, the Nashville Predators came and, you know, they're selling out games. I mean, nobody thought that Nashville was going to be able to support a hockey team and an NHL team. And now, you know, you have a hard time getting tickets. So, yeah, Nashville can definitely support, and there's already a base, you know, for the Sounds. I mean, the Sounds are very popular. So I think that if a team came, that Nashville certainly has the population to support it. I don't know what that would do to the Sounds. I don't know if it would help the Sounds or not. That's something I don't know enough about. But I would think that with the size of the city, we've grown. Our city is one of the fastest growing cities in the country, for good or bad, right now. And it's done in no small part to the series Nashville, because the last 5 years that's been on, it's amazing how people have flocked to Nashville. And now there are people moving here every day at record numbers.
Well, I mean, so, I think I have a personal theory too about Alaska. I mean, there's like 15 shows about Alaska. in the past 3 or 4 years that have come out. So my theory is there's some billionaire that's bought up all this land in Alaska, and now he's just trying to increase the value of it by funding all these shows. I mean, it's a pretty ridiculous conspiracy theory, but I mean, anytime you can just show the rest of America some place that they've never been and then make it seem incredible, yeah, they're going to want to go there. And I have a personal friend that moved from LA to Nashville. He's a director and works in film himself, but he loves it. And because he was living in the valley in LA with his wife and two kids, and it was cramped, it was loud, it was dirty. Now he's got a house, a front yard, and a backyard. He's not 5 feet away from his neighbor. Absolutely loves it. And so, I don't blame all the...
Nashville's it's a great place. And, you know, I've been a freelance filmmaker for 15 years. And I live in Nashville, and I have a house. You know, there are things... If I were in L.A., I might not be doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's...
It's harder. It's definitely a tougher road.
Yeah, definitely. And I like, for me personally, like I'm in San Diego. I just missed you in L.A. and because you were just leaving and I was up there yesterday. So we could have even done this face to face, had it been another day sooner. But, even in San Diego, yeah, it's like, I'm up in L.A. a couple days a week. But it just feels so like the air is cleaner. It's a little bit friendlier everywhere. Nothing against LA. They do what they do up there, and I love that city. But at times it's a bit much when you spend an hour and a half in your car to get groceries. You know, I could do without that.
Well, I have to say we got some work to do, and I'm not going to pretend. As fast as we've grown, now Nashville for the first for the last several years has got issues with traffic and we've got to figure it out because it is not as easy to live here as it was 5 years ago. I mean, when I moved here, in 94, I came from LA. I was living in West Hollywood and I moved here and it was like, I'd won the lottery.
I know. Where I used to live in West Hollywood off Sunset and Harper. Where were you at?
Oh, I was off of Fountain and La Brea.
No kidding. We were, right there. If you saw that Fountain and La Brea intersection now, like where they used to have the John's grocery store, which I'm assuming would have been there then, possibly. But now they've just got that whole intersection built up. It's just apartments that are like 5-6 stories. They're building it into like a little mini city. It's very strange.
Wow. Well, no, I haven't seen that. Yeah. That's progress, I guess.
Yeah, that's traffic. Again, listeners, go to scoutingfordiamonds.com on Twitter at scouting4DMNDS. Molly, I thank you so much for your time and for the interruption there. But Scouting for Diamonds, I love it. And listeners, go to scoutingfordiamonds.com, support this project, because if you love movies, if you love sports, and especially if you love baseball, this is for you.
Even if you just post it on Facebook and Twitter, for the next couple of weeks, that helps.
Yeah, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to tweet it at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. I'll tweet it at a couple of the sports people in Kansas City that I tweet back and forth with that are on the talk shows. I'll try to get some... I'll try to get some retweeting going on for you as well.
We will love you for it. We love you anyway, but we'll love you for that extra.
Well, Molly, I appreciate you coming on, and we'll definitely be back in touch. Keep the listener posted with the project. But again, guys, scoutingfordiamonds.com. Molly Secor, you're amazing. We appreciate your hard work and dedication to the great game of baseball and to film. And we'll talk soon, all right?
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
So goodbye to the bus. Goodbye to
Panda. Hi, Molly. Thanks again for coming on. And guys, remember, go to scoutingfordiamonds.com.
Scouting for Diamonds. Scouting for Diamonds. Diamonds in the rough. That was amazing. Thank you so much, Molly, for doing that.
All what he said, minus the in the rough part. Scoutingfordiamonds.com. Molly Secor, the director and co-producer, along with the legendary Red Sox, Wade Boggs, and Tampa Bay Devil Ray, because he played, not the Rays, Devil Ray, because he was a Devil Ray. He can't be considered.
He was. I agree with that. I did. There was a brief discussion that he wanted to. I think he was actually. You know, we're being nice, but I had heard that Wade wanted to possibly like decide whether he's going to go in as a Ray on his hat, or a Boston Red Sox B. And I think that's when the Hall of Fame basically stepped in, and they had decided from that point on, they made a rule that the Hall of Fame was going to decide what. What was going to be on your hat?
Is that a fact? They now decide. So
I believe, but they may have changed it too. They might ask the opinions, because I think there's I know there was a quick thing about there was a brief thing I think on the internet and a couple of the sports talk shows about, hey, should Ken Griffey Jr. be allowed to have his hat backwards on his plaque? Because of course Ken Griffey Jr. was kind of known for wearing his hat backwards. That unfortunately wouldn't be nice to Seattle Mariners fans, because you wouldn't actually see the logo. Although, well, I guess he did play with two different M's on his hat.
Well, yeah, and then you got Cincinnati, you know, and then you're like,
but he's not a Hall of Famer. But that's the also thing. It's like he has deep roots. His father was a Cincinnati Red, part of the Big Red Machine. And it's like he could have chosen to say, like, hey, well, I want to go into the Hall of Fame as a Red since I spent more games there. But there's a certain thing where, you know, this is for the fans or for the legacy. Like, no one wants to see Jordan's wizard uniform on his bus.
Just anywhere, period. Like, if you see it, just right. Throw it away, because it is just disgusting. Hideous.
Right.
Just a hideous time in the NBA for his jerseys, as far as I'm concerned.
I did see him play a lot. I saw Jordan as a wizard.
I saw Jordan as a wizard also. I drove 6 hours to Chicago. We got there at halftime. He's playing against the Bulls on a very, 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 very cold January day. It was one of those like 12 degrees kind of thing. We almost died in the car driving out there, spun out on the highway in snow. And
the good times.
Went to Rock and Roll McDonald's before they tore it down. The very Rock and Roll McDonald's Wesley Willis used to sing about.
Oh, yeah.
Rock and Roll McDonald's. Okay, we can only sing that twice, or else Skippy Simon's going to show up out of nowhere. I was like,
oh, that's true. It's very true.
But yeah, no, so, but I felt like at that point, I had to see Jordan. I mean, he was the guy that I had six pictures of, or posters of, you know, on the walls. The shoes that I didn't wear, Jordans. Right. You know, these are the don't wear basketball shoes. You know, hundreds of cards, all that stuff. So I'm like, I got to see the guy at least once before he retires. And I think he scored 6 points in the second half. It was disgusting.
I've never worn or owned a pair of Jordans in my life, and it's not that I don't want to. It's that it's sort of like, you know, there's shoes that you might like, but somehow they just don't go with you. Like wrestling shoes. I always thought it'd be kind of cool to wear wrestling shoes. Just, you know, or bowling shoes. You know, they're just different kind of footwear. You like them, but it's just, that's not you. You're putting up you're not Ducky from Pretty in Pink. You can't wear bowling shoes just around. You know, and you're not a wrestler, and you don't have the right kind of jeans for the wrestling shoe. That doesn't taper
early.
Right.
See, a 5th grade, 7th and 8th grade version of myself did look pretty fly in Jordans,
right?
If I do say so myself, along with Penny Hardaway.
I had the little Penny.
I had the little pennies, you know, with the Spike Lee commercial.
I put that out once again. I put this out before every Super Bowl. Please, please, some Super Bowl commercial, bring back Little Penny. Little Penny, just bring back Chris Rock.
What are you doing, man? Just jump be little. On.
It's one of the greatest. Will
you bring that up?
When I talk to Chris,
will you just drop a Little Penny seed?
Little Penny should help host the Oscars with Chris Rock.
And 10% of all benefits actually go to Anthony Hardaway as well.
Don't say that, because that's not true.
I think he needs our help, man. I don't know.
I think that's true.
I got a feeling that guy might be.
I think we need a bar rescue for Anthony Hardaway.
I think that guy might be banking. See, Anthony Hardaway, I love. That guy was the legend at Memphis State before, when they still had the state.
Memphis? It wasn't, or is that just, that's when he, but that's like, the, isn't that the Calipari Tigers? I mean, is yeah. It, or one of those guys.
Yeah, it's their early run.
Right.
But yeah, it was Memphis State. I think they got to the Elite Eight 1 year or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's like, it was like Magic Johnson 20 years later. Here comes Anthony Hardaway at 6'7", 6'8", point guard. There was nothing like him.
And remember what he did with Shaq, not just on the Orlando Magic, but in the movie Blue Chips with Nick Nolte.
Oh, incredible. I mean, if you want to play someone in a barn in Louisiana Bayou somewhere, it better not be Anthony Hardaway. You are in trouble.
That was Shaq who played in the Bayou. They had to take a swamp boat. That was, but yeah, yes, but yes.
I thought Anthony was
no.
On his
Anthony
team.
Was the he was the played at a Catholic school in Chicago, okay. Where all the coaches were camped out. Like your Jim Boeheims, who by the way is in his last season, I believe, here at Syracuse. Your Pitinos, your Lou Carnesecas, your whoever was hot at that time when that movie was made. Your Jerry Tarkanians.
It was a great era of basketball, both collegiately and professionally. You had Jordan's career winding down. Shaq was really
you
in
had
the
Nick
prime.
Nolte playing a character that was inspired by Bobby Knight, and Bobby Knight was actually in the movie. So it was like Nick Nolte is doing a Bobby Knight impression, wearing like a sweater. Basically, he's Bobby Knight coaching at UCLA. That was basically the movie.
I think maybe we need to do an episode where we just watch Blue Chips and yes. Then do commentary over the entire movie.
I don't know. It's hard for me not to masturbate. It's so good. It's a really good movie.
It's a classic. It's a classic movie, to say the least. Anything before we get out of here?
Go Patriots. Let's win this game.
I'm going to be rooting.
I appreciate that, Cheese. And I appreciate you. I appreciate all Cheese fans. And by the way, Cheese fans, I do not gloat. I am not in your face about it. I am only chastising the Cheeser personally for how he personally treated me and try to.
Which wasn't mean. It was just a little cocky.
Yeah, and a little. And also, while promoting the show on various social media, was taking advantage of being in control of our social media.
Hey, I've offered you the password many times. I'm like, in fact, I'll give it to you as soon as we get done recording. And, that way you can put up whatever you would like.
And hopefully we'll be doing that a lot more on our road to the Super Bowl. The road to the Super Bowl. Hopefully it goes right through Denver as we go to
Levi's
Stadium.
Please, go right through Denver.
I need to come out to sunny California, southern northern California. I need to play for the Super Bowl. Go Patriots. Do your job. And that's all I have to say. Stay obsessed, everybody.
Until next time, guys, go to @Sportsaholics, Twitter. Remember, go to scoutingfordiamonds.com and check out Molly Secor. Her projects here in previous, but guys, feature. Stay obsessed. We'll see you next
stay
week.
Obsessed. Hop to the top.